This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, a young Central Illinois woman looks back at the year she became a farmer. We'll hear how one man is trying to save his shrinking hometown. An aspiring teacher gets a chance at her dream thanks to a change in state law.
It's a great job to me. I like the small classes. I like to help them with these basic core skills so they can move on with their lives and be successful and feel good about themselves. What is more valuable than that?
With student debt such a problem, we'll visit a classroom where personal finance is the subject. The hunt is on for some rare musical instruments, and not many towns have a poet laureate. We'll introduce you to one right here in Illinois. That and more coming up on this week's Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll learn more about the impact having a parent in jail or prison can have on children and some ideas on how to improve the situation. There was a change in state law designed to help with the Illinois teacher shortage. We'll talk with a woman who says that change opened the door for her to fulfill her dream. And also coming up, how one man is trying to help save his small hometown. All ahead on Statewide. '19 was a memorable year for farmers, not in a good way. Trade disputes cut into prices and drove up anxiety. A soggy planting season led to a late harvest, and just as farmers finally were able to get into the fields in the fall, it snowed. For 27-year-old Gracie Weinzerl, 2019 will be memorable for an entirely different reason. It's when she became a farmer. Ryan Denham has that story.
This fall, Gracie became the proud owner of her very own 20 acres of farmland near Stanford. It's about 20 minutes west of Bloomington Normal. Gracie's family had rented and farmed the land for years, but now it's hers.
To me, it's the home farm. It's where my great-grandpa farmed. It's where my grandpa farmed. It's where my dad's farmed. It's just right up next to the old farmstead.
Buying it was no easy feat. A little 20 of farmland doesn't come onto the market very often. Plus, land is expensive, about $10,000 an acre around here. 27-year-olds, like Gracie, don't have a lot of collateral to help get a loan.
This is a great opportunity for me to get my foot in the door and decide, you know, is this something I want to do?
Gracie is an outlier, a young female producer in an industry dominated, at least on paper, by older men. Primary producers over 65 now outnumber farmers under 35 by more than 6-1. That's a widening gap that the National Young Farmers Coalition says should concern us all. Gracie has gone from farm-adjacent kid to college student and now landowner. Her journey is one possible path for navigating the many barriers that prevent young people from farming. As a kid, Gracie would go for the occasional tractor ride, but she was never super engaged in farming. It wasn't until senior year of high school that she began to see ag as a career. She tried ag education, wasn't a good fit, and landed in ag communications. She spent about 5 years working for some big ag companies in St. Louis, but returned home to Central Illinois last fall to take a job at the Illinois Farm Bureau.
While I was in St. Louis, I realized just that I was disconnected from the farm, but I missed my combine rides. I wanted to come out. I wanted to know what was going on.
Most cropland in the U.S. is rented, not owned, by the farmers who work it, and Gracie's family was no different. A few years ago, Gracie found out that one of her family's landlords might be interested in selling part of one of the fields.
I can't buy all of that, but I'd be interested in a piece.
Gracie had just come up against the number one challenge facing young farmers, inability to access farmland. Both first-generation and multi-generational farmers cited land access as their top challenge. It's according to the 2017 National Young Farmer Survey. Gracie found that lenders were not too eager to loan her all that money, especially since she didn't have any other assets to her name. But she got help from the USDA's Farm Service Agency Loan Program for Beginning Farmers, which offered slightly lower interest rates. It took about 5 months of paperwork, a lot of questions, way harder than buying a house, which Gracie also did this year.
Essentially, we're in this partnership together where they are lending me money, and you know, they want me to be successful. They would not have given me that money if they didn't think I could make a go of this.
But in mid-August, Gracie closed on the purchase. She had her 20 acres.
It's like, I feel like this is a huge financial accomplishment for me, but then it also sinks in because they hand you the schedule of payments. It's like, I have to make payments through 2049. That's cool. That's the rest of my life. Whatever.
You can't do much farming without equipment, and that's another barrier for beginning farmers. New tractors and combines cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. And again, Gracie got some help. She worked out a labor trade agreement with her father and uncle, paying to use their equipment by putting in hours on their operation.
As a starting farmer, if I didn't have family in the business, I could not survive on 20 acres with the equipment I would need for a corn and soybean farm, which is what I know how to do, what works best for the land around here.
Gracie is learning from her dad and uncle, getting a handle on the equipment. She already knew plenty about crop and soil science, in part because she studied it in college. Soon, she'll be choosing her seed and chemicals and making countless other decisions she can't yet anticipate. Many of them will be financial.
I won't lie in that I'm nervous in knowing whether or not I am good enough as a business person to be able to sell my crop and make sure that I cover all of my costs.
The latest USDA census shows the average age of a primary farm producer in this country has risen to 59 years old. The number of young farmers is not keeping pace with the number of farmers aging out of the field. That's according to the National Young Farmers Coalition, which argues that federal farm policy should do more to address barriers to entry. The latest ag census showed more very big and very small farms. The number of mid-sized farms, between 500 and 1,000 acres, has actually dropped by about 30%. Maria Bernjan is an assistant professor of agribusiness at Illinois State University. She says those who inherit farmland often end up selling it to other farmers in the area who are looking to expand.
So as you have fewer farmers doing that work and more opportunities off the farm for the younger generation and fewer people growing up on farms in general, I think it's really sort of a natural progression that average farm operator would be getting a little bit older each time we do one of these census reports.
Another barrier is time itself. Young people who grow up on the farm and want to take over may have to wait for dad, mom, or even grandpa to retire. Farm income, which has declined nationally since a peak in 2013, can only support so many people.
And I have a lot of individuals in my classes here at Illinois State that are looking at that exact situation.
This dynamic plays out again and again. 67-year-old John Olson farms corn and beans in McLean. He left the family farm himself for about 10 years before returning at age 30. His parents still did a lot of hand-holding those first few years after he and his brother took over. Olson's dad technically retired at age 65.
He crawled out of the combine for the last time at age 87. So 22 years after he retired, he actually retired.
Olson recalled the demographics of a room full of farmers a couple of years ago at a professional development event.
I'm just blown away with a room full of 300 people. And I think the last time I did this, I was 62 or 3. And I think I was throwing the age curve off to the low side being there. I think a lot of the guys that were there were older than myself.
Bernjan's advice to young farmers is to network, get to know more established farmers and landowners, or even ask to job shadow with one.
You know, you kind of treat it as almost a job interview. You make it known that you want to become a farm operator, you want to rent farm ground or increase the number of acres you're renting. You produce a farm mission statement. You produce a document that says, here is my mission as a farmer. Here's the equipment I have available to me. Here's my experience. Here is how I will take care of your farmland if you choose me to be a renter.
I caught up with Gracie Weinzerl on a recent Friday afternoon during harvest. She had a tractor cab full of leftover Halloween candy. She waited for Uncle Dave to dump another load of corn so she could drive it over to the grain elevator in nearby Stanford. Gracie says she's not ready to ask for a bigger share of her family's 500-acre operation until her dad or Uncle Dave decides to retire or step back.
You know, farming is a very multi-generational thing, and so right now, honestly, there's not room for me on this farm.
When Gracie thinks about the future, including expanding to more acres, she doesn't see herself ever becoming a full-time farmer. She enjoys her full-time day job at the Illinois Farm Bureau in Bloomington and the health insurance it provides. In fact, that 2017 survey found that young farmers feel a lack of affordable health insurance puts them at significant risk.
Right now, I am content. I'm learning how to farm. I'm also making sure that I have a solid income so I can reinvest eventually in the farm.
If Gracie does take over the operation one day, she'll join a growing number of female farmers. About 41% of farmers in their first 10 years of farming are women, and the total number of female principal operators increased by nearly 70%, according to the last Ag Census. Some of that increase, however, may be because the USDA is getting better at tracking the roles that women have long played on farms. The 2017 census captured more demographic information from up to 4 producers per farm. The USDA also added questions about who makes different decisions on the farm, finding that female producers are most heavily engaged in the day-to-day decisions, along with record-keeping and financial management. Gracie says her grandmother would often drive trucks filled with grain to the elevator. Bernjan saw the same thing.
My grandparents in southern Illinois filled this census out numerous times, but my grandmother was as much a part of the farm as my grandfather, but under the old collection system, those types of things wouldn't have been captured.
It's not all doom and gloom for young farmers. They've got some advantages. Gracie is fluent in social media, has her own podcast called A Farm Kid's Guide to Agriculture, uses those to connect with other young ag professionals. She's also comfortable with on-farm technology. Her dad and uncle use AutoSteer and have been collecting yield data from their machines since 1999, but they haven't done anything with it.
So I'm really interested to dig into that this winter, is to start seeing consistencies in the field, just see what's going on.
In her little 20 acres, Gracie's also running 4 trials right now, trying out different cover crops and fungicides, learning now so she can make better decisions later, just like farmers have been doing for thousands of years.
That's Ryan Denham of member station WGLT with that report. The landscape of Illinois and the Midwest is dotted with small towns, most struggling to survive, and a key is keeping and growing population. Here's a story from a shrinking Kansas community called Neodesha. A wealthy businessman there is hoping to save his hometown. He's launched a program to pay college tuition for Neodesha students. The idea takes its cue from bigger cities, but it could face some unexpected roadblocks. Celia Yopes-Jepson with the Kansas News Service brings us this report.
Ben Cutler grew up in Neodesha in the 1950s, when it had 1,000 more residents than today's 2,300. He left Kansas for a career in finance and insurance, but never forgot his hometown, situated about halfway between Wichita, Kansas and Joplin, Missouri. And his business success has led to this. That's Neodesha's 300 middle and high schoolers in their auditorium recently when they learned Cutler will pay their college tuition. They have to earn a 2.5 GPA and tick other boxes, but the Neodesha promise will cover the price of tuition and fees at this state's priciest public school, the University of Kansas. Deja Pouncil is a senior. She wants to study dental hygiene.
I'm still in shock right now. I've been really saving up for college. I know most of my classmates have been also saving up, working real hard, and this is just a real relief off of our shoulders.
The program has 2 goals. Obviously, change lives. Right now, 2 years after high school, fewer than half of students here are working on a college degree. Second goal, bring people to this rural town. Families need to enroll their kids in school here by the 6th grade to get the full deal. Cutler's offer is good for the next 25 years at least, possibly decades beyond that. It'll likely cost tens of millions of dollars. But here's the problem. Bordering school districts have been losing enrollment as well. 2 nearby districts have fewer than 200 students left because most of Southeast Kansas is shrinking. Neodesha's plan might simply shift people around among dwindling towns. Matthew Sanderson is a sociologist at Kansas State University.
If you're thinking about regional economic development, at least at this stage, it looks more like a zero-sum game.
To spur real growth, Neodesha has to attract more employers and jobs. And though community leaders say promise programs elsewhere have benefited economically, they're usually in more populous places, like Kalamazoo, Michigan. That town has 75,000 residents. Still, hundreds of workers commute to this town every day from across the region for manufacturing jobs at plants like this one, Cobalt Boats, where a team is building the hull of a luxury motorboat.
So this process just gets repeated. Layer by layer, resin and glass are applied.
Company president Shane Stanfill says now maybe more of his workers will move to town to take advantage of the free tuition, and others would follow.
And with that, they'll need jobs, and that will also help us to get, you know, find the right people to work for us.
But aspiring residents may need to get in line. Neodesha's other big challenge is a housing shortage, a common issue across rural America. Funder Ben Cutler says the town is ready for the hard work.
I don't think any of us that have been working on this scholarship program now, I've been working on it for a couple of years, think that this is going to be easy. This is going to require some heavy lifting on the part of the school, on the part of the community, on the part of the businesses here.
Meanwhile, Matthew Sanderson says he's curious to see if Neodesha can pull something off beyond the usual zero-sum game. A town this small trying to reinvent itself with this incentive. I'm Celia Yopis-Jepson in Neodesha.
Quad Cities has been chosen to host hundreds of competitors from one of the fastest-growing sports in the country. It's the 2021 U.S. Masters Championships for the Professional Disc Golf Association. One of the organizers will be Chase Roberts. He's the owner of a disc golf supply store in Moline.
I mean, we obviously have a slowdown season when it gets too cold, but you know, one of the great things about it is that anybody can play it, and it's relatively cheap to get involved with the game.
Roberts says the association chose the Quad Cities because it successfully hosted two previous national competitions in 2007 and again in 2017. For the uninitiated, he says disc golf is similar to golf with something resembling a frisbee.
They're actually a little bit more like a discus that you would use in track and field than they are a traditional frisbee, but we still have some discs that resemble the frisbee form. Those are putters. They're slower speed discs. There's mid-range discs that are a little bit better for control, and then there's drivers and distance drivers for high-speed and long-distance shots.
The game is scored the same as golf, but instead of holes, competitors putt into baskets. The 2021 Masters Championships will be for those age 40 and older and will be held in September of next year. Roberts says the Quad Cities is a hotbed for disc golf, with 11 courses in that area and a total of about 40 within easy driving distance. There's more of Statewide on the way. Next up, teaching kids about personal finance. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, a town in Illinois with its own poet laureates. And when a parent goes to jail or prison, it can have a devastating impact on children. We'll hear more about that. Student debt reached its peak last year at about $1.4 billion in federal loans. Many borrowers who are well beyond college are still paying them off. Susie Ahn introduces us to a high school class teaching kids about personal finance in hopes of bringing down the debt.
It's first period at Cary Grove High School in northwest suburban Cary. Teacher Laura Jacobson is talking to a room of sleepy juniors and seniors in her family and consumer science class.
Guys, we're going to be talking about default, deferment, and refinancing.
She's teaching them personal finance, which can be an abstract concept to a bunch of teens. But Jacobson thinks these lessons are very important, and that's why she gets personal. She has two adult children who she helped pay off college loans. She brought in their actual financial statements.
I put up their account statements, and it showed how much interest I paid and how long it took me to pay it. And they're like, you owe that much? And I go, yeah, I didn't have the money in savings. I had to take a couple loans out.
The curriculum is part of a semester-long course called FinEdge, a program created by the University of Chicago and Magnetar Capital Foundation. The curriculum focuses on personal finance with a heavy focus on college debt. Rebecca Maxey is with the University of Chicago and oversees the program. She says Jacobson sharing her personal story has an impact on students' understanding. She says some of the assignments require students to ask an adult about their finances.
Research says you should do it, and we know from our experience here that having that home connection is great, but it can be a little nerve-wracking, especially when people are taught not to talk about money.
Students in Illinois are required to take consumer education to graduate, but it's up to individual schools to include personal finance. Maxey says many students still aren't getting this level of exposure. She says for most high school kids, student loans are their first encounter with debt.
They don't know what they're getting into. They don't understand the consequences and the ramifications that, you know, 20 years from now they could still be, or more, they could still be paying off debts.
By the third quarter of this year, 14 million borrowers in the 35 to 49 age group owed a collective $564 billion in federal student loans. Though a much smaller group, some people in their 60s are still paying off that debt. This is the second year the FinEdge curriculum is used in classrooms. Maxie says it's too early to say how well it's working, but she says external evaluation shows that students' financial literacy has improved. College sophomore Daniel Buey agrees with that. He took a similar course when he was in high school.
It was just extremely beneficial because I would have gone to college blind, like not really knowing where I can do. Like, that's considered towards my mom because my mom is the one that's paying for it.
He says after taking the class, he did some thinking and made some financially based decisions. He got into his number one choice for college, Northern Illinois University, but decided to attend the more affordable University of Illinois at Chicago. He switched his major from psychology to marketing, a career he thinks will be more lucrative.
Taking out loans isn't fun, there's interest and it accrues. And, you know, I just thought about like my mom, you know, like how much like she would have to work because NIU was not cheap.
Back in Laura Jacobson's class, she says even if students don't take out college loans, the lessons apply to other future decisions, like buying a home or paying off major medical expenses. Jacobson says a few parents have thanked her for the course and said they wish they'd had something similar when they were teens.
This is Adulting 101. Should you have your mom call the bank?
No.
You can't have your parents call on your behalf.
Because one day, she tells the class, it will be their responsibility. Susie on WBEZ News.
Having a parent behind bars can negatively impact a child for the rest of his or her life. I had a chance to speak with reporter Maureen McKinney about her latest story on the impact of a parent's incarceration on a child and what can be done to protect those bonds. So Maureen, what led you to look at the issue of children of the incarcerated?
I was looking through some bills that were approved last year, and two caught my eye about children of the incarcerated. One was to create a task force to look at the issue of what can be done to help. And the other requires judges to take into consideration how defendants' children will be impacted by their sentence.
You've written about this just recently, another Illinois Issues piece that you put together. Give some background on that, a bit of a recap on the earlier story.
Last week focused on the harm that's done to children when their parents are incarcerated. They are more likely to end up in prison themselves, more likely to have health issues, mental and physical, and more likely to use drugs. People I talked to said that's why creating the task force was important, that we need to look out for those kids whose parents are already in prison or in jails awaiting sentencing.
Well, Maureen, can you describe some of the problems the advocates you interviewed cited?
First of all, like 80% of the women in prison are parents, and the locations aren't conducive for people who live in Chicago. Of the women who are in prison, 40% are from Chicago. And the prisons are located in Lincoln and Decatur, which are 180 miles approximately from Chicago. They also talked about visitation, how that can be extremely scary and off-putting for children. One advocate talked about children seeing their mothers and being very excited, and then they run up against the glass, can't touch their mothers or reach out to them, and they get very, very frustrated. And the mothers will be so upset about that, they won't want to have the children visit again. And visitation is important because it helps keep up the bond between parents and child.
So can this issue be dealt with quickly?
Probably not. It's a problem with the criminal justice system in its entirety throughout the nation, so it's not unique to Illinois. Illinois does have some unique situations, like the largest women's prison Logan in Lincoln has real issues with its visiting area, for instance. Children who are coming to visit find it to be cold, barren. There aren't a lot of toys. I guess 33% of jails don't even have contact visits, which the advocates are really supportive of.
That's reporter Maureen McKinney. She wrote about how children are impacted by having a parent in jail or in prison. And you can read her full story. We have a link at our website at statewideshow.com. Politics, television, and social media were once again rich sources for abuse of the English language during the past year. They're the main contributors to the latest list of words and phrases banished from the Queen's English for misuse, overuse, and general uselessness, as Herb Trix tells us more.
The 2019 banished list is the 45th to be issued by Lake Superior State University in Michigan. In past years, it was overseen by the Public Relations Office, but this year it became the responsibility of the English Department. Mary McMinn is an associate professor of English and creative writing and a member of the Banished Word Committee.
I think that the list serves a really interesting role. There are a lot of organizations nationwide that nominate a word of the year, like the Merriam-Webster Dictionary does one, the Association of Linguists does one, but they just nominate one word of the year, and it's sort of like experts nominating that. And this list, as far as I know, is the only list where the American populace can actually nominate words. So it's a way for people to be word watchers themselves and then sort of keep an eye on the language.
And the winner, she says, hands down with the most nominations, is the phrase quid pro quo.
In Latin, it just means something for something. And it actually comes, the first reported instance of the phrase is actually all the way back in the 16th century. So it started with apothecaries when they would substitute one medication for another. Sometimes they would intentionally substitute them, but another times they would fraudulently substitute one medication for another. And as the years passed, it started to be any substitution of one thing for another. And then it started to have the negative connotation that we have with the word, with the phrase now, where it sort of means pay for play.
From the pretentious section of the list comes the word artisanal, which appears on a lot of menus these days, trying to make your water or salad dressing or sandwich sound more exciting. And from the explosion of foodie shows and sites comes mouthfeel.
That was one that surprised me, too. But basically, it's the word that is used to describe the texture of a food in your mouth. But texture isn't good enough. You have to say mouthfeel, which is kind of gross because, where else are you going to put your food? Are we going to talk about foot feel or hand feel?
And then there's literally.
The word literally means it's a synonym for actually, right? And the way that it has been changing over the years is it actually has become its own antonym. So instead of meaning actually, people are using it for emphasis or for figurative. So I could say, I was so surprised my head literally exploded, which would mean that my head actually exploded, but people are using it for emphasis, meaning that my head almost exploded, or for figurative. So it's a very interesting word that it's become to mean its opposite.
McMinn says an important source of words and phrases for the banishment list in recent years has been social media, including friend as a verb, Google, selfie, and ghosting. The latest additions, thanks to social media, include chirp, jelly, and tote.
One that was new to me was chirp, and I talked to my students about this one. They had said that it was an insult that millennials use to talk about somebody who is insulting someone else. So it's a verb, sort of like tweet is a verb, where you say, I tweeted about this or that, and you're talking about what you're saying on Twitter. But chirp is sort of like talking about something, but talking about it negatively. So I could get chirped for being out of touch, basically, for not knowing that word.
Jelly now is an abbreviation of the word jealous, while tote is another abbreviation for totally. And if there's some use of a word or phrase that really bothers you, some new and terrible pretension, or let's face it, something on social media that us older people just don't understand, Lake Superior State University accepts nominations all year round. Just go to lssu.edu/banished. I'm Herb Trix.
The city of Aurora appointed its first poet laureates. Yvonne Booz tells us more.
Karen Fulette Christensen is most comfortable surrounded by books, like here at the Aurora Library, West Branch. She's written around 3,000 poems and has created several collections of her work. She shares these with close friends and family. She flips through one of her many manuscripts. Then she finds a poem to read.
We went out to clean the riverbank, big black sacks, heavy gloves, sturdy boots, to clear the bottles and cans and shoes and carts and tires and tanks and beds and cords and bikes and on and on and on. What are we thinking? Are we so rich that nothing warrants our attention? The night before, we saw the Dalai Lama smile.
That poem is called Trash in the Dalai Lama. It was written April of 2008. Fulette Christensen started writing when she was 14 years old. She started by journaling, which eventually turned into poetry. She says she was inspired by her English teacher.
I brought things in to show to my teacher, and he was very encouraging. In fact, I won a National Teachers of English writing contest.
And now she's the first poet laureate of Aurora. Fulette Christensen says she wasn't going to apply for the position.
I was encouraged by some friends to change my mind, and so I did. And when I saw the application, I changed my mind completely.
She says the application had meaningful questions, and it showed that the staff of the mayor's office had done their research. Fulette Christensen is a retired city worker, but retirement didn't stop her work within the community. In 2013, she co-founded a local poetry group, A-Town Poetics. She credits this group.
I think the work that A-Town Poetics has done in the community in terms of raising awareness about poetry, in terms of hosting some curated readings and events, helped my name rise to the top.
There were three other finalists. Those finalists are now Deputy Poet Laureates. They include Anthony Stanford, Quentin Johnson, and Fermina Ponce. She says she plans to work closely with them.
But I also hope, along with the three other people that are going to be part of our little poetry posse, that we can reach out to organizations in the community.
She says her mission is to work with the city's young people.
I'm hoping that we can encourage kids to write, to not be afraid of writing, to not be intimidated by the notion of poetry.
Fulette Christensen said poetry is her preferred platform because of its power. In the poetry section of the Aurora Public Library, West Branch, she admires the work of her role models.
This looks like all the poet laureates, well, many of the poet laureates. So Billy Collins, one of my favorites. I love him because he writes about everyday life.
Collins was the poet laureate of the United States between 2001 and 2003.
And while he was poet laureate, he created a program called 180 Days of Poems.
She says she wants to incorporate something similar in Aurora. Fulette Christensen will hold the title of Poet Laureate through April of 2021. An official installation ceremony will take place in January at Gwendolyn Brooks Elementary School. This ceremony will include the Poet Laureate as well as the three Deputy Poet Laureates. I'm Yvonne Booz.
A longtime collector of rare sheet music has died. Lee Schreiner donated much of his collection to Northern Illinois University, where it found new life. Jenna Dooley has that story.
In 2014, Lee Schreiner of Rockford started donating his collection to his alma mater. Librarians at Northern Illinois University created an online database for the World War I sheet music, which is now in the public domain. One of the pieces is called the 3rd Illinois Infantry March, played here. During an interview in 2017, Schreiner says every piece in his collection has a story.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to look at small town Illinois sheet music that was published by someone in a small town that had something they wanted to say.
Schreiner died January 2nd after a long battle with lymphoma. He was 70. I'm Jenna Dooley.
You're listening to Statewide. Stay with us. Next, the hunt for some rare musical instruments across the country and right here in Illinois. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, a woman who had been hoping to become a teacher gets some help from the Illinois legislature. Want to hear a piece of history? That's a more than century-old pipe organ purchased with help from the Carnegie Foundation. Andrew Carnegie is remembered for his philanthropy. The industrialist wound up giving away an estimated 90% of his fortune to causes like libraries and education. But less known was how he helped many churches and community centers obtain pipe organs. The foundation called the organ matching gifts benefactions. More than 8,000 were manufactured and distributed around the world, including 207 here in Illinois. But that was a long time ago, and tracking down those organs, if they still exist, requires some detective work. Paula Romano is a concert organist, teacher, and early music scholar. She joined me to talk about the effort.
This was a benefaction that was not widely known, and this came after the time when he gave the money for the libraries. And libraries went really all over the world. But the organs did too, but there were not as many as we have, you know, throughout the United States. In Illinois, though, Illinois was the third largest number of organs that the foundation helped to provide the money for, and there are 207 in our state.
But of course, not all of those are still operating.
I've unfortunately found some stories of where the organs were just dismantled because the church had no longer been viable, or they couldn't raise money to keep it tuned, things like that. Occasionally you find that they might end up in somebody's basement or taking a ceiling out of a room and putting an organ in there, but sometimes they were given away. They were given to other churches to use. One such place was an organ that was in-house already, and the people didn't know what to do with this house, but they gave it to a university in Michigan, and all of a sudden it became one of the practice rooms or one of the small recital halls. There is in Virginia, Illinois, in a town of 1700, there is one, it's a Hook and Hastings organ, and what's so unique about it, the only thing that has been done in this 130 years has been that they just put an electric blower on it. And that one, when my father was a little boy, he used to pump that. That was his way to give his service to the church. And so he would hand pump it, a little whim machine, and you had to keep it pumping or to keep the air in it. But he had to also do it when the organist was going to practice. I think he was looking forward to getting a little bit older so he didn't have to go do that. But I've been able to identify almost 90 of the 207 organs, which all came from one builder called Hook and Hastings, which is out of Vermont. And then there is another company, which is out of the Pekin, Peoria area, and it's Henners. They were quite prolific in their instruments that they put in around our area. And it was not a name of an organ builder that I knew that well, but another forgotten thing for Illinois.
Do you know why Carnegie was so interested in giving organs? The library thing makes some sense to people, mm-hmm. but maybe the organs, was there some personal connection there?
He sort of had an Anabaptist. He was a Swedenborg, but enlightened thought, not much doctrine. But he gave a church to the church where his family had attended. And before he knew it, there was a Catholic church that heard about what he had done for his home church, and on it went.
Do we know how many of the 200-plus that were given in Illinois are still in use, though? Do we have a pretty good number on that?
Well, that's where I'm a sleuth right now. I've been sleuthing for a couple of years. And we have 97 Hook and Hastings, and I've been able to find out what churches they are. Part of it, not all of these instruments went into wealthy churches. So wealthy churches could afford to change everything around and say, I want to get a blank and blank electric organ. And so they might have been taken out. These instruments, I think, that have stood the test of time.
I would imagine through the decades, fewer and fewer people know how to play these instruments.
Not true. Because it's been the other way around. You think that it is diminishing. To be an organist is you have to be an entrepreneur yourself. And you have to spend a lot of years going to school. And it really, what we do as organists, it isn't matched. What we have isn't matched with our what you're given as money. But I don't think any of us can really do anything else. But like this instrument at the Christian Church in Virginia, Illinois. I had played there. I practiced there when I was a young girl, and they were really sweet. They let me get a key, and my father used to sit with me and be there, so I wasn't alone in the church. But that's happened all over. In this little town of Virginia, Illinois, they have had about 12 organists from, say, 1920 through now that have come out of this little town of 1700. I think with the interest in historic instruments, we're seeing that churches are going to be able to perhaps get their instrument restored. It's sort of hand in hand. A lot of organists didn't stay with playing the instrument, giving up their Sundays for something they weren't going to get a lot of money for, or the church didn't take care of their instruments, was falling down. But we're finding that changing. Over the last maybe 15 years, there have been colleges that have ramped up their teaching of instruments. We're finding new organs going all over the place. So it is an exciting time. But one of the things that I'm hoping that we can do out of this project is to find organ builders that are really interested in these early organs of the 1900s and being able to hopefully get through Carnegie to see if they can help with a fund that we can also make another grant request to help these people in the churches that don't know where to go. Sometimes it's way beyond tuning, that we can have them sing again.
Paula Romano talking with us about pipe organs Andrew Carnegie helped make possible for many churches and local centers. She says there were more than 200 in Illinois. She's working to find out how many still exist. You can learn more at our website at statewideshow.com. In an attempt to alleviate Illinois' severe teacher shortage, state lawmakers last year removed a requirement known as the Basic Skills Test. That test had proven to be a stumbling block, especially for people pursuing the profession later in life as a second career. The change, enacted just 5 months ago, has already opened the door for Kelly McConaughey. She spent the past 11 years working as a paraprofessional or teacher's aide assisting students with special needs in an East Moline middle school. When our education reporter Dusty Rhodes first interviewed her last spring, McConaughey became emotional, talking about her three attempts to pass the math portion of the test, all to no avail. She sounded happier this week in a phone interview with Dusty.
So this was your first day of student teaching?
Yes.
And how did it go?
I love this job. I've never loved a job before, I can honestly say. And like, this is a truly just so, it's so my thing. I love it.
So you were a parapro and then you were the long-term sub for one semester?
Yes. So I was a parapro in that room for 11 years. And I wasn't in the same exact room, but I was in the same program. It's the success program. Other schools would call that like emotional behavior. But we've changed the name to the success program because it's more positive.
And these are the kids that, okay, number one, they're middle school kids, right?
Yes.
So you're dealing with the ones with emotional disability?
Yes. I mean, a lot of people say, what do you do? Middle school. Oh. And then they'll say, well, what subject do you teach? And when I tell them, they just think, oh, geez, that's so hard. You know, well, you know, they think I'm so like a saint. And I'm like, oh, yes, that's me. I'm a saint. But honestly, it's a great job to me. I like the small classes. I like to help them with these basic core skills so they can move on with their lives and be successful and feel good about themselves. What is more valuable than that?
This new law is what made this possible for you, correct?
Correct.
So I remember telling you that this law was coming down the pike, that I was hearing that this was going to happen, that I was hearing that, you know, they filed this legislation, and you, well, why don't you articulate what your reaction was to my telling you that?
Well, it was hard for me to trust or have hope because even now, it's still so traumatic what was going on because I'd been testing. This process of me getting my license has been 2 years of struggling and trying and you know, testing and just, it's two whole entire years. That's a long time to try to get a license, you know. And here's what I want to say is that to have test deciding everything is so, it's too much. What is even the word for it? To have one test decide your entire situation, it's too much pressure. And why can't they just take my work, the essays that I've written and the things that came directly from my head and directly from my own creative instincts, instead of can I tick all these boxes on these tests? And it keeps going, honestly, because now I'm, you know, I have to pass EdTPA, which at least it's more of a, you know, holistic assignment. I'm actually using my skills. So I would say that's at least relevant.
So the 11 years that you worked as a parapro, that counted for nothing, right?
Right.
I mean, you have to be supervised by someone now, right? Like when you were a sub, you ran the classroom yourself, right?
Right. I had to do observations, 60 hours of observations. I've observed thousands of hours, but I'm trying not to complain. I'm really grateful. Yes, when you told me they were trying to put this legislation in place to allow me to move forward without one 60-question test, decide everything, when I've proven through my college, my university, that I know how to use strategies. Like, I know how to teach. And I've learned a lot about how to teach, and I've learned a lot from my experience.
It seemed like you didn't want to get your hopes up.
I didn't. I mean, and I still don't. Honestly, I still don't. Even though I'm in the final stages, and I just have these projects to do, and I could actually get my license, I'm still so, what do I say? Traumatized. I mean, it was so extreme what I went through with the testing. I can't get too excited.
That was Kelly McConaughey speaking with her education reporter, Dusty Rhodes. In order to focus on preparing for her upcoming EdTPA test, McConaughey is given up her part-time job. Ironically, she was a math tutor. That will wrap up this week statewide. Thanks for tuning in, and join us again next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this week's program, you can find it and all the others at statewideshow.com. The podcast is available through the NPR One app. Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois public radio stations.